Kane and Rinse Podcast, Volume 13, Issue 604, where we talk about the Katamari Damacy series. Joining me, Ryan Zhao, in Issue 604, we have Chris Amari Worthington.
Hello.
Leah Haydu. I'm not able to come up with funny names for everybody. There's one good funny name that can be applied, and sorry, I'm just not able to stretch it as far as I thought I would.
It's okay. I'm over here feeling the cosmos, so it's fine.
And the Jesse of all cosmos, Jesse Fuchs.
I am collecting on my debt.
So we're going to be talking about the entire Katamari Damacy series today, and so I guess we'll issue a slight spoiler warning up front. There's not much story really to be spoiled. There is some story, but no big revelations that would really spoil your experience of the game, but there might be a few mechanical spoilers along the way. There's a few surprising moments as you roll throughout the galaxy that will best be left discovered by you. If you haven't played the Katamari games yet, go ahead and please do so. At least the two first games have recently been remastered on all modern systems. Katamari Damacy and We Love Katamari, and those are a great starting point for those who are interested in getting some rolling done. Let's start with that first game, Katamari Damacy, which translates to Clump Spirit or Clump of Souls, roughly in Japanese. It's a little bit of a playful translation, but it's that's where the name came from. It was developed and published by Namco with some developer support from Now Production. This was released on PlayStation 2 between March and September of 2004, depending on what region you're in. Not in Europe, I believe that the European market did not get this game until its re-release in November 2020, which released globally on PC, Nintendo Switch, PS4, Xbox One, and I believe about a year later on Stadia, RIP. This was directed by Keita Takahashi, who this was his first game, his first published game anyways. We'll get into a little bit more of his history, but in the time since then, he's become a little bit more of a household name with a bunch of quirky, similar games. You know, the type of games where if you look at them, you would probably guess this is by the guy who did Katamari, right? Mm. We're talking about games like Nobi Nobi Boy on the PlayStation 3, Tenya Wanya Teens, which is not an arcade game, but something that you only really see installed at art installations because it's a large cabinet with a lot of different buttons that you have to press. It's very tactile. I don't think it's a game that's ever had a digital release. I might be wrong about that. A game called Alphabet. There is a Watam, which is a funny little game about a... You know what? That's going to take too long to describe. Go look up Watam. It's quite charming.
It's a square with a hat, and it's pretty fun.
Yeah. Poop that walks around. It's very silly. Krenken's Time Travel Adventure.
That's the Playdate one that is part of their whole season one thing.
Oh, yes,
I played
of course
a fair amount of, and it's a fun little game. Like, very clever, you know, hits its concept.
And an upcoming game called To a T, in which you play as a person who is stuck in a T-pose, which I've already played Cyberpunk 2077, so I don't know if I need another one, but it does look quite charming. A little bit of background details I've taken from L.E. Hall's Katamari Damacy book, which was published by Boss Fight Books. It's a nice little volume on the history of Keita Takahashi, as well as the production and some details about the game. It does talk about the game in very, very basic details. I'd imagine anyone who's interested in reading the book will have some familiarity with Katamari and can probably glaze over some of the very rudimentary descriptions of what the gameplay entails. But there's a lot of really great background details and interviews with Takahashi himself in that book. And so I'm going to be pulling most of this information from that book. Takahashi was enrolled in an art-focused juku, which is a cram school. And then later he enrolled into the Musashino Art University in Japan, which is the same school that Satoshi Kon, which is a great anime film director, and the Hello Kitty designer Yuku Shimizu attended as well. So some very prestigious talent came out of that school. In school, he studied sculpting primarily. He wanted to make something tactile and functional. So he would create kind of whimsical versions of mundane tools with something kind of quirky and fun about them. And you could see some of that sense of humor kind of apply in the games as well. He wanted to do something that was useful, something that was artistic, but didn't require people to go to museums, which he felt was kind of like an exclusionary space in a way. Like, what good does the high art do the average person? He wants something that people can really get their hands on. Takahashi's perception of the world is interconnected and fundamentally hopeful. He dreamed of a world without trash, conflict, and hatred, which we can see throughout the series. After graduating, he wanted to create something fun, but he wasn't interested in becoming a professional sculptor. So he joined the video game industry after not really playing video games throughout university. He played a lot of Famicom games growing up, like Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy, but he was a bit of an outsider to that community at the time. He hadn't played a lot of recent games at the time that he was applying to join the video game industry. And some of this outsider perspective might become apparent in the work that he produces. In fact, he got his job by criticizing Namco's slate of newest releases as uninspiring 3D polygon games without a sense of humor. So he's talking about stuff like Tekken, Ridge Racer, Soul Calibur, Time Crisis, which he just really wasn't impressed by. And he made that known during the interview circuit, which I think perhaps rubs some of the higher ups the wrong way, but at least kind of got the attention of one or two of the people that were kind of lower in the interview circuit who were able to talk to the people up above and say, I don't know, I see something in this guy. He asked Namco why they didn't produce games like the classics that he grew up with, like Spy Kid, Dig Dug, Mappy, Metro Cross, Pac-Man, which you do see references to throughout his games, especially Nobi Nobi Boy, which has a nice little Metro Cross surprise at the end. Japan was just coming out of what was known as the Lost Decade between 1991 and 2000, which was a time of economic instability. During this time, games companies reported declining profits, and many, towards the tail end of this, split their companies into smaller subsidiaries with the hopes that the smaller nodes would be able to attract venture capital. And these smaller subsidiaries kind of needed something to do. They were transitioned into technology development and prototyping efforts and stuff like that, which led to an influx of creative games. The way was led by Konami, who was able to develop Dance Dance Revolution and a lot of the kind of Bimani studio games under this new type of regime. But it carried over to Namco as well. At Namco, Takahashi learned everything on the job. He didn't know how to program or how to model stuff in 3D, despite this essentially being the job that he was hired for. Takahashi was put onto various prototyping teams, where he worked on several games that never saw a release, like Midnight Justice, a game about robbers fleeing from a giant police robot running towards the camera, like the chase levels in Crash Bandicoot. He was put onto a technology development team for what was described like phone booths that were set up throughout urban areas in which you could print photographs, almost like those Pokemon Snap booths, yeah. But using real cameras. And then he was put on a project called Action Drive, a Crazy Taxi-like game with a spy type of theme. Never ended up seeing release as well. But Takahashi, while he was working on the game, felt that the game wasn't any fun. And so he presented his own concept instead. He pitched something wildly different. The queen of all cosmos was kidnapped, but the king was too lazy to rescue her, so he sent his son instead. The prince was much smaller than humans, though, so he had to go around and hit people on the head with his hammer-like head to stun them. And then he'd be able to kind of ratatouille them around with a little steering wheel that he would place on their heads and drive them around, which is why the characters from this game have hammer-shaped heads. It all came from this earlier concept.
I saw some video talk that he gave 15 years ago or whatever, and the one thing I remember is a big screenshot of a sketch by him of a little prince of the cosmos popped onto the back of some guy's head. It was like in a Mario Kart, and he's got this big puddle of drool, not the prince, the guy, coming down from like his right, you know, lip. And yeah, that is literally, but it is imprinted on my brain. It will be there after I forget my own name. Quite an image.
There's a little bit of Super Mario Odyssey in that as well. It's kind of fun to see these ideas kind of circle around again. Action Drive was also canceled. Takahashi had not yet been a part of a successful project, so he was given an ultimatum to either join a guaranteed-to-release product in a minor role or to try his luck at pitching his own game. So he pitched Katamari, It was a concept that came to him on a subway one night, and everybody kind of loved the concept, which is not always the story when it comes to these really unique and innovative pitches. He was given some resources to prototype this with in collaboration with the Game Lab, which is a Namco on-site game school, kind of like the relationship that DigiPen has to Nintendo of America's campus. The prototype was developed in 6 months, and a full version was commissioned. The music was compiled by Yu Miike, who previously worked on, well, previously and in the future, worked on Tekken's 3 through 5, as well as Ridge Racer's 5 through 7. Essentially, it's a very eclectic soundtrack, and we'll definitely talk some more about that later, but it's more of a collection of, I don't want to say licensed music, because it was licensed music in the sense that they paid like actual pop music recording artists to record stuff, but it was not licensed music in the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater sense. Like this is not music that existed beforehand. This was all written for the game, and the strategy of compiling the group of musicians that would contribute to it was mostly popular performers that were maybe a decade or two kind of past their time, and so they weren't as big and as in high demand anymore, but they gave a nice kind of nostalgic feeling because they were still those familiar voices that were, you know, maybe just you hadn't heard them for a little while still.
I think for us listening to this, I mean, unless you are very familiar with older Japanese pop music and other kinds of music, then you're not going to recognize these vocalists. So this feels like a very bespoke soundtrack for the game, you know, voiced by people who we wouldn't know. And, you know, for me personally, I think I would get more out of that rather than thinking, oh yeah, that's Rick Astley or somebody else who I used to listen to and I haven't heard for ages.
Yeah, and of course we have, Leah and I have done a Sound of Play all about the Katamari Damacy series and covering a lot of the music throughout the entire series. You can look for that back in our Sound of Play archives to get a wide dose of some of that wonderful music, more than we can play in this episode here anyways.
But there is a lot. There is so much that that we could choose. So yeah, do recommend having a look at that.
A lot of good stuff. The game reviewed well, both at the time and presently. Back in its original release 20 years ago, it received a kind of accumulated score, according to Metacritic, of around 86, with a user score of 8.7 in stunning agreement there between the two parties. The re-release in 2020 actually saw that increase a little bit to a critics collective score of 87, 1 point higher than it was back 20 years ago, but with a community score of 7.9, a little bit lower. I wonder if that kind of speaks to perhaps changing appetites in the video game community. Who's to say? We don't have any sales information. From what I was able to gather, it didn't sell tremendously well, but it sold well enough to prompt a sequel and a further development of the series. And it sold within the context of a new IP, and especially something that was so outside of the norm. It did have pretty impressive numbers. It wasn't what Namco was hoping for, because of course you always want a genuine smash hit on your hands, but it sold well enough to continue development. So let's talk a little bit about what the game actually is. This is a very difficult one to classify as to put into a genre categorization.
A roll 'em up
puzzle? Yeah. Maybe
it's an action
sort of
puzzle game, sort of. Yeah,
every game's a puzzle game.
True.
For my own personal collection, I list this under the arcade banner because I think that this is like kind of a descendant of like Marble Madness, but it really doesn't fit anywhere nicely. I have written here an arcade influenced physics rolling puzzle, a little bit of an action game in a way, but it's not. Not a clean lineage in any direction. Perhaps inspired by Marvel Madness, but it was never named as a direct influence. It came 3 years after the Marvel Madness-inspired Monkey Ball, which released in arcades in 2001. But that might have been a little bit too soon to qualify as an influence. And of course, all of the individually unique elements of Katamari Damacy, like sticking stuff to the ball as it grows larger and larger, are not represented in Monkey Ball. Let's talk about our histories with the game. Leo, when did you come to Katamari?
Pretty much right at the beginning. I ran across it just in, I mean, that would have been at the time that I was still pretty regularly going to physical video game retailers. So I just found it right around the time that it came out and thought it was cute, thought it was cheap. And I ended up really enjoying it. And that kind of led me to look out for the next titles in the series as they came out. So I had before, starting to prepare for this podcast, I had already played all of the main titles in the series and I replayed them the first. Or not, I guess not the first, but the main kind of six. I replayed all of them, kind of just, you know, casual, not going for score. Although I've done a little bit of that from time to time, you know, to try and get the biggest Katamari. But I tend to find more joy in these games, just kind of experiencing them very casually. So yes. that's yeah. where I did my roll through for this show.
Excellent. Jesse, how about you?
I was just flipping through my collection of PlayStation 2 games and, thinking about, have always been interested in games, you know, throughout my life, but it kind of comes and goes in terms of being interested in sort of the mainstream of digital games. And I'd say 2004 was really a low point, in that I had picked up a PlayStation 2, but entirely because I wanted to play music games. I was just, like, I have 30 discs in here and maybe six of them are not either Karaoke Revolution, Dance Dance Revolution, a different music game and an iToy game or a retro arcade collection or pinball collection. The other ones I have are The Adventures of Cookie and Cream, Psychonauts, and and Katamari. And I think it really was just somehow, even though I wasn't paying close attention to most games at the time, and it really is this remarkable thing about the PlayStation 2's popularity that someone like me could kind of exist in that ecosystem and not be kind of a games person at that moment, but still buying a bunch of stuff because there's so many games in my little niche. But Katamari came across my radar. It was $20, as I mentioned, at my local retailer where I would, you know, Katamari was just such a standard bearer for me and is one of my favorite games because it reminded me how much I like video game ass video games, right? A thing that really is a video game through and through, and did kind of take all that arcade game stuff I loved in those retro compilations and put it in a much more modern context. And yeah, it was the game I would just kind of show off to people that wasn't a music game if they came over.
Very cool. I came to this series a bit late. I think my first... It's hard to pin down a first exposure because it's one of those things where I probably knew it existed. I just didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. My freshman roommate in university he had really great taste in video games. You know, he had Earth Defense Force 2017. He had beautiful Katamari on the Xbox 360. And so I played a bit of that. And that probably is where I really kind of got my taste for the series. But I'm a relatively latecomer to Katamari, but it's been a real favorite of mine ever since then. And I've been, I replay the Katamari games, like not all of them, but I'll replay at least one Katamari game every year. And it's just a wonderful game that I keep kind of coming back to. Chris, what about you?
Yeah, so my history of actually playing the game stretches back all of 7 weeks. When we were originally told that this was, well, I say that. So I was one of the deprived, poor, unfortunate Europeans who actually didn't get the original game or its sequel back in 2004 and when the sequel came out. So I would have had no way of playing this legitimately. Now, me and my friends did have ways and means. And I do have a recollection of either I can't remember whether I'd picked up a demo somewhere at some point, or one of my friends might have been passed a backup, or whether even I had it. I've just got a recollection of playing this at some stage, and it may be one of those false memories, given how much time I've spent rolling balls around in the past few weeks. But I do seem to have a memory. But really, where it started to land on my radar was, the original game has popped up on many top 100 lists of best games of all time. And I'm a sucker for a list like that, although I largely disagree with almost all of them. I love reading through them. And this game invariably will feature on any such list. And the other thing that's really caught my attention over the years has been the music. So listening, Sound of Play, one other video game music podcast, invariably they're going to do an episode on the Katamari series. And I've always thought, oh, wow, I would love this game. Just listen to that music. It's so Japanese. It's right up my alley. But really, the first time I really picked up the game, any of the Katamari games, was literally 7 weeks ago at the start of December. I was absolutely delighted to see my name on the panel for this one, because it was just the push I needed to actually play these games. So not a long history, but a pretty intense short-term history.
So which ones did you play in that time?
In the past 7 weeks, I've played all six of the games that are available to us. So yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, we'll get into it. I'm excited to hear your thoughts on, you know, perhaps you can provide maybe the most kind of clear what changed from one to the next, because you had them all introduced to you in such a recent memory there. But yeah. We'll get into it. So again, we're talking about the first game in the series here. The story is the King of All Cosmos gets drunk one night and accidentally destroys all of the stars and the moon. He tasks the prince with replacing them by rolling up objects on Earth that he will throw into the sky to become a star and eventually the moon. There's a little bit of other story content kind of scattered throughout. There's the Hoshino family, which is a kind of a regular Japanese family. They like watching Jumbo Man cartoons. They go on vacation somewhere, I think. I don't remember that much of what happens to the Hoshino family. It feels like a little bit of a kind of a weird non sequitur. I don't really know the purpose that they serve, but it I guess it kind of maybe imparts the scale of what's happening at the cosmic level with something that's very grounded and human as well.
It feels very detached from the kind of rolling parts of it at the beginning, and they kind of tied in towards the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not the only time that the series does that, but it is kind of jarring in a fun, weird way.
Yeah, I think I think it's very easy to think too deeply about some of this stuff. I mean, what I've read from Takahashi said is that he just wanted to create a different perspective. They're going to see the father, who's an astronaut, aren't they? And he's due to go to the moon, mm-hmm. but obviously he can't go because the moon is gone.
yeah, of course. And so, you know, this all ties into this gameplay, which is the loop of rolling around these levels. And then, of course, as we've mentioned, anything that is slightly smaller than your Katamari, the ball that you roll around, will stick to the ball, and the accumulated mass will become larger and larger and allow you to pick up larger and larger things until eventually you're rolling up entire buildings and humans and airplanes and spaceships and all sorts of stuff. But there's, for as cheery and chipper as it is and as colorful as all the graphics are, there's kind of a little bit of cosmic horror to it all. There's bit of an existential of scariness to it. I wrote a piece that I was going to publish on Canon Rinse a long time ago, kind of about this dual nature. I never got around to actually like editing or anything like that. But one of our Patreon contributors says, you can cynically say that you're using up a lot of objects and living creatures to recreate someone else's empire, while an optimistic view is that you're celebrating all of the mundane things on Earth and making them cosmic. These are the things that go through my head as I get settled in with the bloops and screams rapidly stacking on each other, accompanied by some of the best music in games, K Sera Sera being a clear favorite. So when you roll up humans, they do scream and they do wiggle around.
Yeah.
They run from you when they see you coming sometimes.
Yeah, When you approach a police officer, they shoot their gun at you. They don't want to be rolled up. And eventually they are thrown out into the icy blackness of space. But there's something that still kind of has a prevailing spirit of hopefulness. There's like a there's like this, you know, we are all stardust at our core. We are all connected as, you know, matter in a living universe, kind of a optimism to it in a way. And that's part of the kind of weird dichotomistic like philosophy of the game.
I want to wad you up into my life. Let's lump up and be a shooting star. I forget. You know, trying to remember 2004, where I was spending all my money on instead of video games, was like, I don't know, Chris Ware comics. Not that there were that enough to spend all my money, but like that is definitely sort of peak indie com. Like I think this game I keyed into immediately because that sense of humor, Lewis Trondheim is definitely who I would have been thinking of at that point in terms of that kind of combination of like cute, but yeah, kind of cosmic horror at the same time. If anyone's ever read the Dungeon comics, I feel like the tone there is different, but in the same vein. And I think that's why this game was such a bowled me over, was I hadn't seen that kind of sensibility appear in video games before. Everything, as you said, was kind of brown, except for my little music games. But that's like a, you know, it was a niche.
I posted a picture in our Skype chat that I will mention is a crab with a gun, which is something that I wrote down in my notes, just crabs with guns, all in caps. That, to me, is really kind of the spirit of Katamari Damacy, at least the first game, you know, well, really all of them, but, you know, just weird combinations of things that you might not think of. And, you know, it might, if you see a real crab with a gun, it's probably going to be pretty threatening. But, you know, here it's just, well, we had these assets. What are we going to combine them as? And yeah, it turns out crabs with guns. So
it is interesting. There's this, like, if you take a structuralist reading to Katamari Damacy and the kind of like a study of semiotics, like there's a sense that like any two units of value, when combined with each other, our brains immediately try to kind of form some sort of a link between them and create some kind of a grandiose meaning. And there's so much stuff in Katamari that does come across as being a bit random and a bit, you know, unexpected and a bit silly. But the way that it's presented, like all of these weird kind of crabs holding guns and, you know, snowmen going on a parade down the street and stuff like that. And, you know, businessmen riding on each other's shoulders and doing cartwheels through the cities. And, you know, just all this weird stuff. It does create like a really dense story space, and not that it's telling a story in a Dark Souls kind of way, but it's like it's telling individual little vignettes that to me comes across more like the Where's Waldo or the Where's Wally, depending on where you live, books, where every little corner that you look into, there's something interesting that you can see happening there. And you can kind of infer the story that went on around it and the background of why this person is here and what they're doing there and what this sumo wrestler has to do with this candy shop or whatever, you know, all these odd kind of synchronizing aspects that create such a dense, you could just kind of like a sponge, just wring it out. And all these little interesting stories and vignettes and jokes keep pouring and pouring and pouring. And that's the part of Katamari that to me is the most exciting. It's like it's able to tell stories so effectively just with its space and just with the kind of spatial relationships between what would seem in other contexts like unrelated objects.
Something that I remember from the basically, I don't know if it was the first time that I played Katamari Damacy, but like one of the first times that I was playing the first game, I could remember being given a little bit of pause at the beginning because every item that you roll up, every single one, they are labeled. So they didn't have to do that. Like they didn't have to say, oh, this is a small candy. This is this type of, I don't know, desk supply or whatever, you know, because you're oftentimes rolling through them so fast that you can't really stop and read all of them. And that the first couple of times that I played that, like when I was just getting used to the series, that like kind of threw me a little bit because I'm used to playing things like JRPGs where if something has an item description, you stop and you read it. And these don't really have descriptions per se, but they were all labeled. And I think that is really interesting to me because, like I said, there is world building going on here. It's just not in the way that you might expect from other types of games.
But they do have descriptions, don't they? I mean, I can't speak to the later games because I got a little bit, you got a little bit fatigued but looking through the collections. But certainly in the first one, there are brief item descriptions for every single item you roll up.
Yeah, they're little quips. Donut County, that is definitely a direct influence because there's some very funny, and some of them are funny and some of them are just kind of, you're now just reminding me, like when I made a Flash game for Facebook back in 2008 that had these unlocks, it was a dice game. Yeah, that's exactly who I was ripping off when I was describing each little unlock, was it was straight up Katamari quips, basically.
And you see a bit of that carry forward into Pikmin as well. And it's kind of become like a little genre of like these almost database-like games that...
Everything, I don't think everything has descriptions, right? It just...
No, it just
has
like the behaviors and the noises and stuff.
Even Bloodborne, the pebble is described just as quite thrilling. And that feels like a little Katamari description.
And there are hundreds of these things, literally hundreds and hundreds of them.
Yeah.
You can browse for hours through the collection should you want to.
And it creates that sense of plenitude, right? That sense of the infiniteness of the universe.
Another really exciting thing about the, as you say, kind of the plenitude of these levels and the design of the levels is there's a great essay called The Prince of Objects, Katamari Ant Ontology by Darius Kazemi. And part of what he uses to describe the Katamari levels is that they have a flat ontology, which is a really fascinating concept. Essentially, it means that like that there's in most of video games, there are separate types of objects. There's static objects and there's dynamic objects, you know, and he gives the example of like in a shooter game, you can shoot rockets at a stop sign and it will never be destroyed because that is not designated as a destroyable object. And, you know, there's these separate ontologies that kind of dictate the behaviors of all of these objects. And Katamari is kind of revolutionary in that as you're rolling around as, you know, the size of a sugar cube on a tabletop, you run up against cups and playing cards and larger objects, and those act as the boundaries of the space that you're rolling within.
Yeah.
And you understand that as a gamer, as those are the walls and I have to stay within those walls and, you know, operate, play the game within those boundaries. But as you get bigger and bigger, those become objects and those become game objects, those become dynamic objects, and the larger objects are now kind of occupying that static space. And there's nothing that, well, you know, there are no hard boundaries. Like everything becomes a, you know, everything that was once a boundary eventually becomes a part of the play field, which is such like a innovative and exciting like way to design levels. It's like the golden spiral, or like, you know, all of these kind of, it becomes kind of bigger and bigger as it goes. Yeah, exactly. It has a beauty in that as well, of everything large becomes small at a different scale.
Yeah.
We talked about Dominion and deck builders in the Slay the Spire episode. And I mean, Katamari and Dominion are kind of the two examples I give of feedback loops when I'm, you know, an intro to game design or whatever, because they're, it's pretty straightforward. And one is, you know, spatial in a video game, and the other one is sort of probabilistic in a tabletop game. And in a weird way, it's the same, you know. Yeah. And the fact that Katamari levels are like, they're not randomized in any way. It's always the, at least in the ones I've played, right? They're like, going back to that first game, I had 20-year-old patterns of just like, okay, first you get the pineapples, then the pineapples make you big enough to get the sunflower or whatever, right? That as Ryan was saying, along with maybe my beloved Walkabout Mini Golf, you know, that combination of just, it is level design and environmental design in the cleanest possible way. Of just, you can point to it. And if you're trying to explain what level design is to a student, be like, yeah, there's there's all these objects. There's one rule, you know, things smaller. Yay. You set these values and that creates this puzzle that is on some level, on some abstract level, as, you know, as I was saying, like if you abstract into an RPG or like a Sudoku or something, but it's also incredibly visceral and fun and you don't have to think about any of that. You can just bounce around with your big ball.
The way to get better at the game is to learn how to read the game better, which is, you know, it's not always the case for video games. Like there's so much of video games is about reaction speed and lateral thinking that is outside of the like fundamentals of the systems themselves. But like all you have to do in Katamari to become an expert player is just to like be a better judge of what you can roll at any given time. It feels very attainable in that way.
Yeah, I mean, particularly as in the first game, it is, I found anyway, that it feels more punishing because sometimes when you bump into things that you can't roll up, you might have things bounce off your, actually fall off your Katamari, which means it reduces in size. It never feels punishing, but if as the games go on, that feels like less of a mechanical feature.
Mm-hmm. I would argue that it does sometimes feel punishing, specifically, but like, first of all, the king is extremely hard to please.
Oh, yeah.
Depending on the game, he just is ridiculous. But I may be going off in a different direction here with how it can feel punishing sometimes. But just if you I got really frustrated in a couple of the titles, notably the PSP one, which we'll get to. But not having perhaps always the same consistent cues to tell me what was going to be available to me and what wasn't. Now, usually this is pretty good, but sometimes when you reach certain milestones, you get kind of visual indication that yes, you've sort of leveled up and now you're going to be able to do more stuff. But in between those kind of level ups, you still do gain kind of the ability to roll up some other stuff that might not have as clear of a visual indication. And if I feel like I am big enough to roll something up and then I just bounce off of it repeatedly, that to me feels a little bit punishing, but maybe that's just me taking things too hard.
But you never decrease in size. So when you increase, so the perspective changes. Well, I don't think it's possible to actually kind of downgrade, is it? Once you've leveled up,
I don't think so. No, I don't think that I ever did. If it is,
I've had one thing happen once. I've never downgraded the perspective of the camera.
No.
But I got to the point at which I was big enough to roll over the 30-meter traffic cones, and then I hit something, and I was back down to 28 meters.
Yes.
And I didn't. I am mad at myself for not trying to roll through the traffic cones anyways, because it had already played the cutscene. But you can go back down, but it doesn't like take you back to a previous game state.
Yeah.
The only thing that I found really frustrating, this happens every once in a while, is when your Katamari gets like stuck or wedged in somewhere, and the game reads it as like perpetual collisions, kind of like the you know, people getting stuck in a door in Oblivion, and you just watch like all sorts of objects just go flying and sprinkling off of your Katamari. It's like, no, all of my stuff.
This is one of those games where like I know logically in my head that it doesn't matter how hard I'm pushing the analog sticks, I am not going to be pushing the Katamari harder.
That in this game you do that. It all, because it all feels so tactile. You know, the controls are initially a little. It almost feels well, it did to me anyway. I kind of, when I first started, it just feels a bit weird. You know, kind of rotating the Katamari feels a bit weird, and then within 15 minutes, it just feels so intuitive.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk about those controls before we get too much farther down that path. These are what I call Star Wars Episode One racer controls, in that you have the two thumbsticks in most cases, and we'll talk about the PSP one once we get to it, but you have the two thumbsticks, and essentially they act as the mechanical metaphors, they are the arms of the prince. And if you're pushing both of them forward, then you move directly forward. If you push the left one forward and the right one backwards or to the right or something, then you'll start to kind of arc right. And, you know, it's kind of like rowing a boat or, like I said, operating the twin engines of a pod racing type of, you know, kind of like the old arcade machines with the actual Star Wars, the levers on them. But yeah, I don't know. It's a very interesting control scheme, and it is basically all accomplished just with the thumbsticks, with, you know, some occasional triggers and button presses and some of the later entries that do this and that. But for the most part, what you're doing is just kind of rolling with those thumbsticks.
I think of them as battle zone controls, and I will always think of them as battle zone controls. And it is funny because it never occurred to me what Ryan said, that is totally correct, about them mapping to the metaphor of the prince's arms, like you push forward with your left or right, you know. No, I was just like, yeah, it's a tank, I guess. I don't know why, but it feels good. Sure. Having to flick them back and forth real fast to do the zoomies does feel a little punishing. And I can never quite nail it.
It's a little inconsistent.
Yeah, I could never do it. That's exactly what I was just about to say. In none of the games could I do that. And it feels kind of essential if you want to play for points that you've got to use. You've just got to move quicker than the prince can move in just regular movements. It feels, I could never ever do it.
Once you get larger, a larger Katamari, if you lose momentum, it can be real problem, like, to get going again, because, you know, and that makes sense, because if you're rolling a Katamari the size of a planet and you stop, then this tiny little dude is going to take a second to get it back up to speed. So, but yeah, that's just to say that I think the zoomies buttons are probably important if you are trying for that.
Yeah. Mr. Ixalite from the forum says, the Katamari series are games of great contrast for me. The baseline satisfaction of cleaning up clutter to make yourself bigger is matched by the frustration at getting stuck on table legs and failing to move up narrow ramps with the slightly inflexible movement. The pleasant music and relaxing atmosphere is eventually accompanied by a horrible screeching countdown timer. And when you're finished, palms sweaty, with what you consider to be a good effort, Katamari, you're greeted by a condescending shrug from the King of All Cosmos.
He's a jerk. The King of All Cosmos, not...
That's the
not
sense of humor of the game, though. You have to learn to not take it personally. Like, you've still done a good job.
Yeah, but, I mean, that, just on that point, though, I mean, in the first game, his tone, for me, is absolutely spot on. It's humorously condescending, that you look forward to his... you know, his mild put down jibes to the prince. Mm-hmm. In later games, though, when he's dishing out, you know, a 5-point score for a level that you felt pretty euphoric by just by just about getting the end result that you needed with like seconds to spare, and then he kind of comes up with some horrible line and gives you, "Would you a 5?" That just feels not nice.
Well, this is where the delicate tone of the game being out of the hands of Keita Takahashi probably comes into play. And I think, you know, as we get to the sequels, the tension between art and entertainment is definitely going to come up.
He loses his charm, his kind of lovable, roguish charm that he has, certainly in the first game, to a lesser extent in the second game. That, to my mind, completely goes by the later entries.
Like, listen, my dude, you caused all this. I'm trying to help you. You can just calm down.
Yeah, there's a bit of a Devil Wears Prada quality about him.
Yeah.
In the thing, it was talking about the blaring alarm in the last 30 seconds, which is pretty consistent through the games and is unnecessarily harsh. And in fact, I remember hitting the mute button on my remote control in 2004. Eventually, when it would come on, I don't like it, but I get it. And also the way the king has of talking over while you're trying to play the game, where, you know, right, I think, you know, when you're first playing it, you pick up an item and the first thing that happens is for the next 20 seconds there's a bunch of word balloons obscuring the screen like an ink blot in Mario Kart, where he's just like, oh yeah, I remember picking that thing up or whatever. If you start moving before he's done talking at the beginning, he will talk for like 20-30 seconds about how, you know, offended he is or whatever. I mean, that's the thing, it's brilliant, but that's the kind of thing that maybe doesn't scale to a industrial context where you churn one of these out every year.
Again, I mean, I may be conflating the games here, but I feel like that is a thing that definitely definitely gets worse as the series goes on. I think the king just becomes so chatty by the end. I feel like in the first game, and you know, there are five games in between where we are now and playing that first game, that wasn't really a thing. I don't remember it being too imposing, actually, once you were in-game.
He does it a little. He does it enough to be annoyingly funny. And I think this
and
is
then
the thing.
The early game of We Love Katamari as well, it tapped into the PlayStation 2's clock. And so it would tell you, like, your first collision happened on December 25th. Mm-hmm. And so early in the game, when you're just kind of getting a lot of firsts, he'll be popping up quite a bit, which is maybe not making the best first impression. But I do kind of like, in a way, like pressing start to clear his dialogue before I start rolling. Like, it becomes a little ritual at the beginning of each roll. So there's almost like a little hand washing routine to kind of get you into the mindset. Mm. But anyways, so the standard levels are essentially make a star, get as large as you can within the time limit. There are special challenges as well. They are still pretty basic in this first one, but they get a lot more creative as they go. And so throughout the series, I don't want to kind of highlight the special challenges as they come up. This one has constellation stages in which you must roll up as many constellation-relevant objects. So depending on the constellation you're working on, they could be crabs, crowns, twins, bears, you know, anything. And they are kind of plentifully arranged throughout the level, oftentimes in very kind of amusing, like the entire town is overtaken by crabs, and it's comical how many crabs you're rolling up at any time.
I would like to, at this point, bring up my least favorite level in all of these games, and it's one that they keep bringing back. I think it's in almost all of them,
is
if not all of them. It's the cow.
Yes.
So if you guys don't know, if anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about, so there is a level in the first Katamari that continues to come back throughout most of the other games. Like I said, it might be all of them. I did not track, but it is the king says that you have to roll up either a cow or a bear.
Yeah.
And you want to get the biggest one possible. So the problem here is that anything that is coded towards a cow or a bear will count for this. So, like,
no matter how small.
Yeah. Like, so like a little traffic cone with a cow pattern on it, that counts. A tiny little statue or a teddy bear, that counts. So basically what you are doing, and I think this is why I don't like it, is that most of the levels that I do like, which is like the rest of them, there is at least some kind of idea that you are supposed to be rolling up to get bigger. You know, you're rolling up pretty much everything. You know, when you have to start avoiding things,
yes,
that's where I don't really enjoy that. And like I said, this level just keeps coming back, and that frustrated me a little bit. Everything else, great, but that cow bear thing, not one that I enjoy.
I will say that I genuinely love the cow stage once. It is this, it's just that kind of thing where it's like, it's a brilliant troll. Now what we're talking, I really regret not emailing Bennett Foddy and just asking him, like, specifically what his trolling influence is from this game, because there's got to be some. Of course, if you're going to do that level, you have the milk carton. Of course, you're just the meanest about it possible. And as you said, you make it so that if people don't want to, you know, be the butt of your joke, they can just move on. But I do love that that's there. I just wish it never, ever appeared again. It's done. You did it. And this gets back to, again, the, like, industrialization of what is essentially kind of this oddball piece of art.
Similarly, there are levels in which you have to roll up an exact size. I don't remember if this was introduced in the first or the second game, but it would give you like a little overlay on top of the screen. It'll show you get a Katamari that is, you know, 50 meters, which is, well, that's pretty big. Get a Katamari that's like
10,
50 centimeters.
Yeah.
Okay, something like that. Yeah, that is approximately this size, and you're given unlimited time, and you can choose when the level was over, and it'll judge you against like how close you were to that. I think once before, I believe I've gotten it like spot on, and that felt very satisfying.
Gotten pretty close, but never exactly.
Yeah, that's fun. See, that is fun, and that is an example, I suppose. Yeah, there's a very small select group of levels, I think, which don't involve just rolling up everything, which I actually enjoyed. That is definitely one. That is kind of a fun twist.
And then you can unlock eternal stages, which are essentially the regular stages that remove the time limit. There will be more of that as the game goes on. I think there's only like three eternal stages in the first game. But anyways, you can also roll up cousins, which are other prince-like characters that are just kind of like... In the first game, I don't think they're actually in the levels. I think that is introduced later on, but I think there are still ways of unlocking the cousins in the first game. But they give you additional player characters that you can roll around as. It doesn't make a huge amount of like mechanical difference, obviously, but it's funny-looking little creatures that you can pick up and roll around, and some of them are quite comical and weird. The presentation of the game, let's be pretty brief on this one, as it'll mostly kind of carry throughout the series, but everything, as we mentioned, is very kind of low polygon as a way of managing the memory requirements, because obviously this is a huge, huge amount of objects on screen at any given time. There's a lot to keep in the PlayStation 2's memory. A lot of the very simplistic, low polygon, simple texture art direction came from managing that level of detail load.
I think it's aged really well, the graphic style. I think because it's become so distinctively, you know, I've not played, well, before 7 weeks ago, I've not really played the Katamari games, but even I would describe it, because I've seen what Wattam looks like and I've seen what Nobi Nobi Boy looks like, I would describe these graphics, even without having played the game, as Katamari graphics.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, you know, this game is 20 years old, and I think it's going back and playing the PS2 original, I think still feels, from the look of it, is still feels quite fresh, because I would expect that if a brand new Katamari game was released this year, I wouldn't expect it to look too different.
Yeah, and actually there are a few kind of graphical changes in the remakes that came out over the past couple of years. Reroll not only upgrades the graphics into HD, but it also adds additional shadows and some lighting. And actually you can, in at least We Love Katamari Reroll, press Royal Reverie, the new remaster there, you can go back to the original type of graphics as well. I don't know if it reproduces it one-to-one, but it removes the additional kind of lighting and shadow effects to make it a little bit more kind of simple and true to the original vision. But they've remained fairly consistent with some interesting alterations in the PlayStation 3 version that we'll get to. But very good looking game, very Japanese as well. I like how many like Japanese folklore type of references there are as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the not only specific creatures, like there's, you know, a little girl who comes out of a well, kind of like in The Ring. There's the Kappa monster that we've seen in Animal Crossing and other games that comes from Japanese mythology. But there's a lot of the ways in which the characters are positioned and the things that they are doing are have some sort of a cultural significance, or make kind of a cultural joke. If you're knowledgeable, more knowledgeable than I am about Japanese culture. The music we've already talked about a little bit, so we won't go into a tremendous amount of detail. Again, check out that Sound of Play. This first Katamari soundtrack, I think, is just absolutely unimpeachable. And in fact, most of the rest of the series is remixes of these first two soundtracks.
Yeah.
you know, I don't want to open the can of worms of calling out favorite tracks, because we'll be here all day, even though there's only like 17 songs on the soundtrack. There's really good stuff. Yeah. They're pretty incredible. Back to our community, Simon J. from the Patreon says, I immediately fell in love with the absurd premise, the amazing chunky graphics, the anarchic music, the joystick-only controls, the incredible sense of scale as your Katamari keeps sizing up, and your sproingy sound when you finally get big enough to knock over an animal. I deeply love the play and aesthetics of this weird and singular game, and it is probably the reason I've returned to it is probably the game I've returned to most over the years. I still play the Roll of the Moon level at least once a year, just to get to the point where you can roll up entire islands. Jobo Bonobo from the forum says, my actual introduction to the series was We Love Katamari, which a friend of mine lent to me. Within seconds of the madcap intro with the surreal graphics and bizarre music, I was intrigued. It also does enough to stray away from the basic roll your Katamari to a certain size formula, such as building a snowman and competing in an F1 race. It also has an absolutely bonkers finale with you rolling up entire planets through the galaxy, which definitely ones up the finale of the original. The music must be singled out here. It is such a fun array of different genres and styles with upbeat singing that cannot help but get you in a good mood. We Love Katamari has some real delights, such as Angel Rain, Disco Prince, Katamari on the Swing, and Baby Universe. All of this cements We Love Katamari as one of my top PS2 titles. What a gloriously silly delight. That's right. This is the second game in the series. We love Katamari as it has been kind of canonized with the recent release of the remaster. Previously, even in official sources, it was always written as We Heart Katamari. So it kind of depends on however you want to write it out yourself. But the new re-releases have kind of changed that retroactively. Developed and published again by Namco and Now Production. Released on PlayStation 2 in July of 2005 through February of 2006 in different regions. The Reroll Plus Royal Reverie remake was released on Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, PC, Xbox One, and Xbox Series in June of 2023, just last year. It reviewed pretty much equally well as the first game. Metacritic 86 and an 8.7 user score. Reroll Plus got an 81 and a 7.1 user score. So the story of this game goes that fans of the first Katamari Damacy ask the king and prince for favors. Essentially, it's a very the king is just kind of chilling out and being a little bit lazy, and the fans flatter him with how much they appreciate him in the first game. And he is kind of not tricked into, but flattered into rolling up additional Katamaris for them. We also get the origin story of the king. And it's actually kind of a cute story about when he was a kid and the struggles that he had with his own father. But it's all quite cute and comical. Eventually, in the end of this game, we are asked by a dog to roll up the sun. And so the final challenge of the game is making sure that all of our other planets that we've rolled up throughout the game are large enough so that collectively they are big enough to where we can roll the sun. So that is the final challenge there. We'll get to it.
With regard to the sun level, it's kind of interesting because they force you into that level pretty early just to see that you are going to fail it unless you keep going.
Yes.
So there, I don't think that there is any way to pass that the first time.
No. And I think as long as you've completed all of the other levels that become available, you don't need to worry about making these things as large as possible. I think as long as you've done, because I did pretty badly at some of them, I think as long as you've done all of them, you are guaranteed to you're guaranteed to be able to roll up the sun. Whether you can roll up the sun early, if you do well on the levels, maybe you don't have to pass all of them. I don't know.
There's a little bit of a mean twist on this in Beautiful Katamari, which we'll get to eventually. But as of right now, the gameplay remains pretty similar to the first one with regard to its controls. Its controls have been a little bit streamlined and made to feel a bit better, to such a degree that the remake of the first game adopts the control method that this game utilizes. So now if you're playing Katamari Reroll, it will feel like We Love Katamari and the following Katamaris did back in the day. So you start off this time around in a tutorial stage, small room full of different blocks and puzzle pieces to kind of get familiar with the controls. But
Screaming angels flying around. That's where you get to the end. First shapes, then your reward, screaming angels. Mm-hmm.
The standard levels in this one have two challenges now, as fast as possible and as large as possible. So you not only roll large Katamaris, but you're also, there's a kind of a time challenge type of mode that you can play, I believe, all or most levels in. Those are just kind of optional challenges that you can choose to tackle as well.
What I found in this game, and I'm going to contradict myself here, because one of the things I really don't like about the later games, as I've already alluded to, is the giving of points. But actually, I felt like in this game, it was, you're being graded, because if you do particularly well, you get a shooting star, I think, don't you? Or they call it a meteor. There's some kind of signifier that if you do pass either one or both of those as big as possible or as fast as possible challenges. But I felt like, and again, I am contradicting myself because I don't like the grading at all. But I feel like here you're being graded, but you're not really being given any kind of guidance as to kind of how you're being graded. Mm-hmm. And that was an introduction from the first game, which was just a case of, here's the win condition. If you meet that win condition, you've done it.
This game had a lot more special challenges than the first game did, where you are doing unconventional things by Katamari standards anyways. Let me just kind of list through these, and feel free to jump in and stop me if there are any of these that are particularly interesting to you or if you have good memories of. There's one where you are in a large magical garden and you have to roll up as many flowers as possible. The flowers
Fantastic.
Aren't really... Yeah, they aren't really like physics-y objects, and they are, but they're there's not the same kind of resistance as you get in regular Katamari stages. It's more kind of like you just roll through bushes, you pick up as many as you go. There's a few that you can't get from the beginning, like sunflowers and stuff like that, that you will eventually get to be able to do, but it's the very few boundaries, and it's mostly just roll through the bushes and go as fast as you can. There is a gingerbread house, which is based on the Hansel and Gretel fairy tale. This is a big favorite of mine because it's another one where it's just so much fun to just destroy this house piece by piece. But the house is made of all kinds of different types of candies and graham crackers and, you know, sweets and all sorts of things. And you roll down this path into the house. And by the time you get to the house, you generally are big enough to just start like taking apart the walls brick by brick. And it's so satisfying. Yeah. Such a wonderful stage.
That's a level design one that you can is chunkier than a lot of the normal stages in terms of they all have, you know, those vignettes and interesting level design. But this one, you can probably break it down to like four steps, essentially, and they're all incredibly satisfying.
There is the race in which you are on a racetrack going very, very fast. You're still just trying to get as large as you possibly can. There is some actual racing a little bit later in the series, but this one is still a get as large as you can challenge. But the modifier is that you are moving very fast and it's a little bit difficult to control, but you're doing laps around and picking up more and more as you go. It's still pretty fun, though.
Hey, I like this one. So far, I'm just being convinced this is the best game.
This one's wonderful.
The race, I like the satisfaction of picking up the big rows of tires is definitely the peak experience there.
Yeah. There's the school. You're in a Japanese elementary school, and you are rolling up students and urinals and going between rooms. It's a smaller stage, but it's a lot of silly stuff going on in there. Underwater, this is an interesting one because you're not only a bit slower than you're used to because the physics of being underwater are a bit slower, but you have the obstacle of fish hooks, which are just awful. They're very difficult to see, but if you are caught by one, then it pulls you all the way up to the surface. You have to kind of wriggle your way free, and then you slowly descend back down, and you lose so much time in doing that. So you have to be careful.
I almost universally hate underwater levels in games, but in this one, I actually really enjoyed it.
There's a lot to see under there. It's a very vibrant underwater pond for how small it is. There's like a car that's underwater, like somebody drove it into the pond. There's some silly stuff. Animals. This is a really fun level. I like this one a lot. You are in a zoo. And you have to roll up as many animals as possible. And there are animals all over the place, but more than anything, there are animals of all sorts of different scales, as you would expect. And so, you really have to be thoughtful about, you know, making your way through the zoo and making sure you're large enough to pick up all of the animals that you come across. There is a limited to 50 items level in which you can only pick up 50 items. You're trying to get as large as you can in that time. And again, it's about just trying to just barely squeak by on the picking up things just a little bit smaller than yourself and avoiding things that are too small and aren't going to contribute to that total very much. There's a campfire level in which your Katamari is on fire and you have to roll objects. I don't know if it depends on the properties of the objects, like if wood is better for this, but or if it's just anything contributes to the fire that's burning. And then eventually
I think it's the latter, Ryan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can roll through water. It is a little abstract at this point.
Oh, okay. Okay. There's somewhere it does penalize you on that for later on in the series.
Yeah.
Yeah. This comes back in Katamari Forever, and it gives you an instant fail state if you roll into water, which does make sense, but it also makes this level extremely frustrating.
And you have to take the fire all the way to the top of a hill to light the bonfire. If you don't do that, then you'll fail because you hadn't achieved your challenge. There's a couple that are like that in this one. There's a clouds level, which I find pretty forgettable. You're just kind of rolling in the stratosphere and you're picking up all sorts of different types of clouds.
Only gods and clouds, and you're very big. I am a fan. Yeah. I don't have anything beyond that to say about it, but I enjoy that, sure.
There is the infamous cowbear level, which we have already talked about. There's a 500 paper cranes level, which takes place again in the school setting, and you're just picking up paper cranes, and it's quite enjoyable because there are paper cranes of all different types of sizes, and you can get a whole bunch of them. Fireflies is kind of like the fire level in that you're picking up fireflies in this outdoor camping scenario, and it's nighttime. It's a lovely looking, dark, you know, outdoorsy type of level, and the more fireflies you pick up, the brighter your Katamari gets. There aren't different sizes. It's just about the sheer number of fireflies that you can roll through. And then you have to take it to a person who's trying to read his book at night. There's a couple of just right levels, which is, again, rolling just the right size of Katamari. There's a money level, which I think it's not the one that we've already talked about, which is rolling against a budget. It is rolling the maximum number or the maximum value. Right.
So you can pick up big, cheap things, which will help you indirectly, kind of. It's an interesting equation of that. I do want to say, the fireflies is probably my favorite level. It's just beautiful. Beautiful.
It's nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah. The snowman level is an interesting one as well, because there's a big kind of snowman base in the middle of this level. And it's one of those that you can choose to end at any time, I believe. By rolling onto that snowman base, you're basically making the snowman's head. And so you can roll around, you can pick up objects, but not only that, because the entire level is covered in snow, just the act of rolling is going to make you slightly bigger as you go. This is one I don't know, I don't remember if there's a time limit or not, but it's one that's pretty easy to get everything within. Like, you can get as large as you want to. I don't know if there's like a just right size where if you exceed it, you start to kind of see diminishing returns with regard to your points, but my favorite aspect of this is the kind of inverted cones. There's like a whole bunch of what look like green circles on the ground, a ton of them in one little area, and as you roll over them, you can see they're actually like little pyramids that are stuck into the ground. I don't know what they represent, but it's really satisfying to roll over that entire group of them and see them poking out of your snowball. The sumo level is another really memorable, really funny level, in which there's a sumo wrestler who is too small to properly wrestle his opponent. And so you have to roll him around a village, consuming all of the food that you can. He's eating as you go, which eventually you get large enough to where you can start rolling up humans. And I don't know what the implication is there, but
I think I can figure it out.
Yeah, it's quite funny. And he says very repetitive things as you're rolling and eating objects, which is another, like, hearing the same soundbite over and over again is usually annoying in games, but in Katamari, it's quite comical. There is a messy room. You have to clean up 100 items as fast as possible. There is the roll up the sun, which we've already talked about, which is not a proper Katamari stage. It's more of like rolling in a straight line and seeing if you have enough to pick up. It's very directed, but we get more interesting versions of this later on in the series. And then eventually save the Earth, roll up a meteor that is headed straight for Earth. We get big enough by rolling up countries at the global scale, which cleanly separate by their national borders, which is a pretty good joke as well. This is a standalone level that is incorporated more seamlessly into the general progression of getting bigger, starting in beautiful Katamari, which I think is where it becomes more interesting.
I really enjoy that in order to save the world, you have to roll it all up into a Katamari.
You have to essentially destroy the world, yeah.
Yep.
Pretty funny. But there's some minor changes to the gameplay. There are great clears and super clears, which you can achieve by doing very well, by achieving certain kind of milestones, by going fast enough. But anyways, the music, again, I think is a major highlight of the game. This game has a wonderful soundtrack. Everlasting Love on the racing stage is a real favorite. There's just so much good stuff in this soundtrack.
I think it's the biggest game. Is it the biggest game as well? I mean, it's certainly the game I spent the longest playing. I think this one probably took me around 12, 13, maybe even 14 hours. Whereas the others were all kind of...
I think Katamari Forever probably has more levels just because that one is kind of like a greatest hits album. But definitely has a lot to do in it. DeMonth from the forum says, a bit of a shame to see how hard they cashed in after the first two, because Katamari Damacy is basically one of the most genius ideas for a game ever, and We Love Katamari is one of the most genius concepts for a sequel ever. There's no greater shame in gaming than the king blasting you for having a pathetic small Katamari. I think it's a testament to the design that half of the levels are just kind of annoying, but I still put either of the entries in my top 20.
I think We Love Katamari is kind of important because it's the other one that Kenta Takahashi actually works on.
That's true. That's a good point.
And he did not want to make it, you know, right? At first. Yeah. It was made under, not exactly protest, but basically the story I heard, which is apocryphal, is that Namco literally showed him like the King of All Cosmos wearing a Santa hat. Is like, they're like, you know, we can make this without you, and it's going to be an entirely Christmas theme version, which I don't think they would have actually done. But that was apparently how they impressed upon him, like, look, it's going to happen. There's something very peremptory about it. There is kind of this beautiful passive aggressiveness of, I am going to make you all shut up by doing every good idea possible with this thing, and then maybe you will stop. And they didn't. Right. But that is really I don't know which one I like more, because the first one's kind of the perfect little one. But then this one does do that. You know, this is someone essentially being creatively exuberant in an attempt to exhaust an idea and let it die. And I like that creative tension. It reminds me that my favorite Buster Keaton movie is The Cameraman, which is the first one he makes after basically he has to be working for the big studio. And, you know, he's really struggling against their commercial requirements. And the tension there between, you know, the money people and the artist create something that either one individually, like, I think Takahashi was wrong to not want to do this in a way. I'm glad they forced his hand. Then everything Keaton does after that sucks because he just kind of gives up and gets beaten by commerce. And that leads us to the other games, not all of which are, you know, but that do not have his imprint and, you know, to varying degrees, as we were talking about with the Reverie stuff, just feel like extruded Katamari content.
We start that journey with the PlayStation Portable entry, Me and My Katamari. Now, this was released on PlayStation Portable in December of 2005 through May of 2006 across different regions. This is directed by Shuhei Kurose and Yutaka Yoshida. This reviewed a 75 accumulated score, according to Metacritic, and a 6.4 user score, so definitely a step down from that. The story of this one is the king and family on tropical holiday cause a tsunami that wipes out the local islands, and it's up to the prince to replace them. The big thing that we should note up front about this game is the thing you might be curious about is, how does Katamari work with only one little thumbstick nub on the PlayStation Portable?
Poorly. Doesn't.
Yeah. Essentially, it is digital controls this time around. It employs a similar control scheme. They try to recreate a similar control scheme anyways, but it is using the D-pad and the face buttons rather than the two thumbsticks. And so it's still operate similarly to where if you push both of them forward or push one to the front and one to the back to turn, but it's not the it doesn't feel as good, and it becomes a lot more difficult to control in certain aspects. Even though, you know, I played this one on the Steam Deck and I was able to remap the controls to thumbsticks, but even
now,
so
that's just cheating, Ryan.
I know.
Well,
but even
I did
so
the same thing. I'm going to back up Ryan here. I did
oh,
the same
come
thing.
On. Did anyone play it properly?
No, I have played
but
the original
are,
version.
They are still digital at heart, and
yeah,
it doesn't
exactly.
feel
you still
as,
can't do the full 360 right. movement. It's just your when you hit your cardinal directions, you're doing it on the stick rather than the arrows.
It really hurts. I mean, I played it on the PSP, and it really it does. I mean, I've only got small hands, but I kept thinking, oh, I'm going to get used to it at some point. Like, at some point in a minute, it'll just all click, and I'll forget what it felt like to use two thumbsticks. And nope, It didn't.
To the game's credit, though, some of the special stages, which you reach by going to the volcano island in the menu, were actually pretty creative, and I ended up liking a lot of these a lot. So let me just kind of go over these five special stages. There is the ant that tasks you with rolling up as many sweets as possible in 5 minutes, pretty standard. The crane, roll up old objects for a total age of over 3,000 years, which I really love this one. It's so funny that like all of the different objects, not only the people, but also the objects, they tell you how old they are once you roll them up, and you're just trying to pass 3,000 years. You don't really have to do anything special, but it's just a funny way of kind of recontextualizing these objects, which I thought was pretty clever. And I don't think that's ever been back in the of later games. The gorilla asks you to roll up energizing objects and make a ticket to the rocket within 5 minutes to basically serve as rocket fuel. The chameleon is this is another kind of Tony Hawk like level where you have to roll up specific object categories based on requests that are shouted out by the king. You have a very limited amount of time to satisfy. He'll ask you like roll up 4 water objects, or roll up 4 fruits, roll up 5 children, and you have to satisfy I think like 9 of these different requests or something to win.
And he'll troll you and he'll say, oh, this one's really easy. And you're thinking, I can't fail this one.
Yeah. And so it teaches you to not get too greedy and not roll up any more than you have to. You know, it pays off to get large, but it's nice to know like, okay, I do have some fruits I left behind over there in case I'm going to need them later. And then the final special level is the camel, which asks you to roll up valuable objects obscured in the desert sands. Most of the objects, sometimes you can see little bits of them kind of poking up above the sand, but most of the time it's kind of invisible. And so you don't know whether they're going to be small or large or whether you're going to be able to absorb them. It's a little bit difficult and it feels a bit hostile, but it's still kind of clever enough to where I kind of give it the benefit of the doubt. It's kind of like a metal detector type of stage in a way. I kind of like it.
Again, it's never been close to coming back either. I mean, they did nothing like this in the later games.
As far as the graphics go, it's impressive with regard to it being on PlayStation Portable. It's nothing that, I don't know, it's not going to stand out from the rest of the series, but I think it kind of survived the transition. Chris, you actually played this on the hardware it was intended for. Yeah. How did it look on the little screen?
It looked really good. Yeah. It did. I mean, the art style carried over really well. It kind of never really lost that kind of fidelity, you know, in terms of the clarity of the objects that you're picking up. You know, it kind of, the humor carried over really well. Although, you know, you might not be able to make out, you know, the crabs with the guns just as clearly as you could. It still managed to convey that sense of whimsy and humor in the stuff that you were rolling up. I thought it worked. I mean, the presentation worked really well. You get that kind of customary PSP motion blur, you know, which I think sometimes helps the presentation. But it did. It looked and sounded really, really good. I mean, there was certainly no complaints there. If the PSP had two proper thumbsticks, it would have played really well. But the PSP doesn't, and therefore it makes it a really difficult recommend.
The only thing that I kind of didn't care for as much, or you know, thought was questionable with regard to how they brought it to a portable system, is that obviously since the processing power on the PSP is lower than the console, it's not going to be able to support typically quite as stages that are quite as large as they are, or as long, just with regard to the time that you get to roll around. So I think they typically stuck to like 5 minutes or so. They do have some larger stages, but the way that they handle that is that you get your one timeline, or your one kind of time limit cut off, and then you start a new time limit. And I didn't really care for that, just because like if you fail on your third section of something, then you do actually have to do the whole thing again, and you can't like carry over. A couple of times he'll like give you an extra 30 seconds or an extra minute or something if you have enough time when you're going into a new section, but you can't, like, if you finish something really fast early on, then you don't get to carry that time forward really. So that I didn't love how that, I mean, I see what they were trying to do, and it is definitely a way to kind of compensate for that. But I think there might have been a better way to do that if they just focused more on maybe the types of stages that Ryan described as like the, you know, the kind of more original type things instead of trying to have kind of the same. And also they reuse the same areas a lot.
It's really repetitive. Yeah.
That's the thing. So if they tried to do more kind of different types of things, if they were going to reuse that same area, then do more stuff with it, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know that that would have worked better, but those were the things that kind of stuck out to me as being, well, sticking points, aside from obviously the controls, which, okay.
Next is the series' first mobile spinoff, which there are a few of these. All of them are currently delisted. You cannot currently download Katamari games from either App Store, I believe. But the first one, Katamari Damacy Mobile, which was developed for the Mitsubishi P904i mobile phones back in June 2007. This was developed by Namco Bandai as well. Gameplay, this was all tilt-controlled using a new technology called Gesture Tech iMobile, which used the camera of the phone to calculate when and how the phone was being tilted. So it didn't actually have any tilt sensors in, like, within, but it would try to kind of infer based on the visual image how the phone was being moved. And if you moved it too fast, then it would lose its track of, you know, space and time. But it is no longer playable, so we'll leave it at that. Next, Beautiful Katamari came to the Xbox 360, an interesting move from a series that had always been on the PlayStation previously. It was originally intended to release on the Nintendo Wii and the PlayStation 3. Must have been the PlayStation 3 as well. Mm-hmm. But only the Xbox 360 version ended up surviving its development cycle. So this was released on 360 in October of 2007 through February of 2008. And it was made backwards compatible in 2021. So if you have an Xbox One or an Xbox Series, then you can currently play, download and play this from the digital store. And it plays really nicely, actually, on the new hardware. Yeah, again, intended to launch on the Wii and PS3, but those versions were canceled. This was directed by Jun Moriwaki, who was a designer on Me and My Katamari, and it reviewed reasonably well. It got a 73 Metacritic and a 7.2 user score. Basically, the gameplay is pretty familiar. The big thing that it adds is the final level, in which you can you start off at a like smaller than human scale and eventually roll up large enough to where you are doing the like rolling the countries by their national borders like you do in We Love Katamari, and eventually even leaving the planet and rolling out into space, picking up stars and planets and the king of all cosmos himself, and then rolling into a black hole to plug it up. It's the game that introduced the kind of full-scale journey of the Katamari, which I really, really like this one for that reason.
Although I failed that final level about three or four times, that's a long final level to have to repeat.
It's probably one of the most... Yeah, I think it's longer than that. There's one where there's a level that's like 24 minutes, and I thought it was
that's
that
in
one.
That's the first one, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think this one's 20 minutes, and yeah, I've played it. I was one of those where I thought, I can't go to bed until I've finished this, and I ended up playing it about four times.
So controversially, in order to roll the 1,500,000 kilometer Katamari needed to complete the game in that final level, you can't do that with the amount of planets that you would end up rolling through the course of the game. So
yeah, I did it. I didn't have any of the DLC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, same, actually.
I guess this is what I read. So I don't know if like maybe the community was misinterpreting it, but it sounded like
maybe
all of the DLC stages
point.
That might be it. But it sounded like the DLC stages must have been purchased and completed to get to that stage. That might be apocryphal. It might be maybe something they addressed later on.
Maybe there is another version of that stage that opens up when you have the DLC. I don't know. I didn't get any of the DLC either. There's a lot of DLC for this game, though.
There is, yeah. And we'll talk about those individual stages just in passing. But just wanted to highlight these special stages that were introduced on this one. There was one called a roller roaster, in which you roll up hot objects while avoiding cold objects to reach a total of 10,000 degrees Celsius. You auto-fail if you touch the water, which is a bit frustrating.
Mm.
I don't hate this one, but it is kind of funny.
I think it's okay, but it is tough.
Yeah. You feel the you feel your heart sinking when you accidentally roll into what ends up being like a huge group of snowmen or something, and you just see your number plummet all the way down.
See, that's not so bad because I think that's your own fault. You snowmen are cold, but it's when you roll up things that you don't necessarily know are cold that it can get really frustrating.
There's the shiny circuit in which you roll up as many ring-shaped objects as possible. Kind of funny. And the Chateau Notre Désir, roll up objects as requested by the king. Again, one of those kind of like call and response type of levels. Back to the DLC, the stages were only a few kilobytes in size, which lead most to speculate that the levels were included on disk, which makes purchasing them separately a little bit of a scummy move, but...
Well, it's kind of the peak time for that kind of thing, right? Like, that was when these types of things were being pushed super, super hard. So it kind of doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, there are 7 DLC levels. There's Munchies Manor, roll up as much food as possible to get calories. Lover's Loom, a size challenge in a level that's full of yarn balls and all sorts of yarn-related objects. The Hubble Horoscope, roll up constellation-relevant objects, kind of a throwback to the first Katamari game. Fancy and Schmancy, roll up as many inexpensive things as possible before your budget runs out. We've talked about that. It gives you 300,000 yen at the beginning. I really like this stage. I think it's a great addition. Mechanical Colony, roll as large as possible in the store, which has a bunch of mechanical objects and electronics all about. Dangerous Colony, start at ocean scale and then maximize at global scale. It's kind of like an abbreviated version of that final level that doesn't have the interesting bits at the beginning and doesn't have the interesting bits at the end. So I don't know why you would play this one specifically. And then the Instituto Exactamundo, which are 3 as close as possible stages rolling to exact sizes. So, you know, there's a couple of really great additions in the DLC and a few that are pretty forgettable, I'd say. This has multiplayer. You could play 2 players on the same console or 2 to 4 players over Xbox Live, both co-op and competitive. This is the last game in the series that has online co-op, I believe, unless any of the remasters do, which, of course, you can play. I don't know. I think you could play the new ones, multiplayer, local multiplayer, or the Steam kind of virtual local multiplayer as well.
Have you guys played the multiplayer? I didn't get to do it.
I have not.
Only back in the day, but I do remember We Love Katamari's multiplayer being very fun and very, again, kind of Bennett Foddy-ish. Very, three-legged race-ish. You're both trying to push it in different directions and yawing at each other.
So you wouldn't be playing two different... You wouldn't be rolling around 2 different balls, right? It would be 2 players on the same ball, maybe?
No, I'm trying to remember. I think there was a competitive, like, split-screen one, maybe.
Okay.
But... In We Love, I think it was 2 people pushing the same ball and having to try to coordinate. Yeah.
That sounds just horrendous, that, doesn't it? Where you each control like an analog stick almost. Sounds very difficult.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's very clumsy.
Yeah.
Anyways, this one looks great on the modern consoles. You played at 60 FPS on the Xbox Series. It plays really well. I think it's a great addition to the Xbox library. And this is Yumi Ike, I don't think was involved in the music for this one, but it kind of retained a similar ethos in a way. Another delisted phone game followed this one, Rolling with Katamari, which is a 2D game with sprite art in it. Part of the game involves rolling up the innards of a phone, which is kind of funny as well. You roll on the circuit boards and you pick up all the little resistors and stuff like that. Essentially another delisted game you can't play at this time, but another kind of interesting step in the process. I Love Katamari was released on iOS in 2008 and has since been delisted. It was released on Windows Phone in 2010 and Android through the Samsung store and only on Samsung phones in 2012. I looked and it is not available on my Samsung phone any longer. There's another mobile game called Korigashi Puzzle Katamari Damacy. Sorry, this is not a mobile game. This is a DS game, but it has also been delisted, so to speak, with the death of the DSi store. But this is a spinoff of the Pack Attack series of puzzle falling arcade games, with some Katamari theming and some nice rearrangements of some of the familiar tunes, but otherwise it plays just like a Pack Attack game. Next on our journey is Katamari Forever, the PlayStation 3 entry, which was called Katamari Damacy Tribute in Japan. This was developed by a team called Genki, who previously had done Fighter Destiny, Rally Challenge 2000, Tokyo Extreme Racer, published by Namco Bandai and Infogames. This was released on PlayStation 3 between July and September of 2009. Music, Yumiike is back on board for this one, arranging some remixes of past titles, as well as I think there might be some original music in here, but I think the soundtrack for this one is really great. I really like
these remixes.
There's some good stuff in here.
Yeah.
Let's see. The reception was a little bit lower. This one came out at a Metacritic of 74 and a user score of 7.6. And essentially, this one is like a greatest hits album more than anything. I think most of these stages are returning from previous games, sometimes with a tiny little bit of a twist, sometimes just making you do the same thing you did before, but with nice kind of spiced up PlayStation 3 graphics and a couple of different graphical modes as well. You can unlock the ability to play stages in different like visual filters, like a cell shading mode and like a version that applies like a wood grain type of filter to some of the textures in the game. I think it looks really nice. I think it plays really nicely. Personally, like this is my favorite Katamari game. Like I know it's not as important in the series, but it's just like it's kind of the basic, like you can say that a band's greatest hits album is your favorite album because it has all of your favorite songs on it. And that's kind of how I feel about this one. It just has like it has all of the Katamari levels I like. It has a lot of Katamari to play through. There are two kind of separate parallel campaigns. There is a, to contextualize it in the story, the King of All Cosmos gets hit on the head and suffers from amnesia. So half of the levels take place in the King's mind as we revisit older worlds and try to restore them in their memory. And half of the levels follow the Robo King, who was built by the cousins to replace the king during his absence. So kind of parallel stories across there, but it kind of breaks it up between these two campaigns. One of them is just the like get as large as possible stages, and one of them is more of the kind of special request, more creative types of stages.
So I think that I actually agree with Ryan, what you said about, this is, I think, my favorite entry in the series, but I think it is my favorite entry in the series because of everything that came before it, because it's kind of it's not redoing those things, but it is putting some twists on them, like we mentioned the music remixes, which I really like. If these were the only versions of those, I'm not sure that I would have liked them as much, but the fact that they are taking things that I already enjoy and kind of tweaking them that little bit. Same thing with the presentation. Like, this is a beautiful game to look at, and it's got some really nice things, like the King's stages, while he is still unconscious and you're in his memories, they start out just by default as like these black and white stages, and then as you roll up items, those items become colored in. So, you know, it's like as you are doing this, you're kind of bringing something back to him. Also, the writing on the Robo King is just this depressed robot that is really funny to me, like in a super dark way, but like this is the most anxious robot I have ever seen. So yeah, there's that. Also, the cousins are little freaks in this one. So
the use of color there, it has a mechanical feature as well, doesn't it? Because it shows you as you're rolling around the environment, if something's colored, you know that you've collected one of those before. Yeah, so you definitely can roll it up, and it just adds a kind of an extra mechanical dimension, I found.
I think it's a great game, and it's unfortunately the only game that is unplayable on modern systems because the Beautiful Katamari, well, from the four console entries anyways, because Beautiful Katamari was made backwards compatible, this is the only one that is currently stuck on the PlayStation 3.
I woke up my poor little PlayStation 3. It's sleeping. Whenever I wake it up, I feel like it's going to die on me, but it did fine, so.
It wakes up and says, "How dare you leave me on when you experienced a power outage?"
Exactly. Who disturbed my slumber?
if the king didn't award every single one of my Katamaris with a 5 or a 10, I think I would also say it was my favorite, but he did, so I won't.
Yeah, that element of scoring it. I hadn't played this one previously, and I borrowed it from the Game Center and re-hooked up my PS3. And yeah, I mean, this is exactly where my ambivalence comes in, and I think there's genuinely, you know, video games like this is a thing that is made by Namco, and and like Madden, like you iterate on it, and it gets more polished, and it gets better, and that is genuinely part of it. It's also right. It is. I don't know. I don't have enough of a dog in the Taylor Swift fight to have opinions about her re-recordings versus the, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Of there's commerce reasons these things are done, and then we experience them, and how much, and you know, because I played those games originally in 2004 and was waiting for We Love Katamari and kind of knew the rumors about he didn't want to do it, but he's going to kind of settle it once and for all, etc. The same thing happened with Dark Souls 3, right, which is a very fun game, but also kind of felt a little bit like Miyazaki being like, fine, a bit of ennui, a bit of season 33 of The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. Going on, where it could still be good, right? You know, and but would this exist? If does this need to exist? Yeah, I the new mechanics. I did like that coloring thing. The hop mechanic kind of depressed me. It definitely felt like someone trying to put something in here that, like, okay, or and also there's like a heart that sucks up a bunch of stuff, right?
I do like those hearts. Those are actually part of the new mechanic called King Shock, where you magnetize nearby objects. There's usually one of each type of heart in each level. There is the heart, which for a limited time, nearby objects of a rollable size are sucked into the Katamari. And then there is the broken heart, in which is kind of an immediate burst of everything nearby of rollable size getting sucked into the Katamari. It's an immediate boost, but it felt very arcadey. It felt like something that would be from a Pac-Man game or something, you know, some of those early types of arcade games. It really kind of brings it back to the roots in a way of like a immediate score boost. And it feels good to do. I kind of like it. It gives you a kind of an immediate level up, so where you can start rolling much bigger items. And there's a little bit of strategy of like, when do I collect the heart? When is the most advantageous time that I'm going to need that additional kick in the right direction? But I kind of like that addition myself.
That's the thing, is as a mechanic, like, I could see either side on that. And it is more of just this personal reaction of, right, when you go back to something that, you know, has a personal identifying place in your life, that I don't think I can enjoy this in the same way, even though it's perfectly good. And again, you know, it's a video game. It is a thing made by a bunch of people that they have to polish up as a machine.
As we said, most of the levels are rehashes of previous levels. There are a handful of new ones. The only one that I feel like really stands out in my memory as being like completely new is the Katamari Sprinkler, in which you are in a desert level and there are some pools of water. And you can hold a certain amount of water, and as you roll around, basically everything that you touch is kind of sprung back to life with, you know, plants and fauna and stuff like that. And so you're essentially watering the desert, but you run out of water pretty quickly, so you have to return to one of those pools of water to collect some more. Sometimes it could be a little tricky to do that, and sometimes there's some kind of platformery types of areas that are a little bit difficult to reach, so it's a bit annoying to run out of water while you're up there. But that's the only one that really felt like a brand new idea to me.
Yeah, it's kind of a direction as well. It kind of gives you kind of an idea of where it could go, you know, if it was going to come back, and the kind of thing that they could do, because that was a very different stage to anything else that we've really had.
But primarily, it's a great assist album, but I really like it. I got this one running on the Steam Deck as well, just, you know, PS3 emulation. It works really, really well on the Steam Deck. I've been thrilled to be able to play it again. This was the first game that I ever bought for the PlayStation 3. I bought this and my PS3 at the same time, so this was with me from the very beginning of my PS3 journey, I don't think I could have picked a better game to start with. It's one that I frequently revisit, both on original hardware and through the Steam Deck, and I'm just always so happy when I play it. So I really hope that they bring it back at some point. I know it's probably the most annoying one to port over and probably the least demand, honestly, but it's such a wonderful, like, greatest hits album that I hope that it becomes playable at some point in the future again. Next, Katamari Amore on iOS. This was, I think, a pretty big deal at the time, relatively, to some of these mobile games. September 2011 on iOS only, delisted on March 2015. It plays like a pretty standard Katamari game. It is 3D this time around. Any thoughts or memories about Katamari Amore? There's another similar one called Tap My Katamari later on that I kind of get the two mixed up a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. Any thoughts there?
I played some iOS Katamari game, but I think I would have remembered if it was called Amore.
Yeah. Next, Touch My Katamari. This is the kind of arguably the last game in the series, in the main series anyways. This is a PlayStation Vita release. Released back in December of 2011 through February of 2012. This one, the king overhears people talking about how the king doesn't seem so cool and relevant anymore. And the king has kind of a crisis of ego. Mega Dirt from the forum says, Touch My Katamari on Vita seemed to completely miss the point in many ways. It felt like playing a game I loved while I had a terrible stomach bug or a migraine. There were many irritations, but it was particularly bad in the writing and the king's personality. Instead of coming across as childlike and whimsical rascal, he would come across as an arrogant and condescending bully. He looks a bit weird, too. He's got like a photo mapped to his face.
Yeah.
And so he looks like a, like I say, like a Cosmo D character, like somebody from Tales from Off Peak City or something like that. Just a bit of a weird fit.
He's horrifying because now he has human eyes and human teeth. And I don't like that.
Yeah. Like, and the human characters are really weird as well. Like the art style. I mean, the game looks lovely because the Vita screen is lovely. Mm-hmm. And the game itself looks great when it's in motion when you're playing, but the art style in those cutscenes is really weird.
And the art style while you're rolling too is just like a little bit off. Like, it's just not the same design ethos that went into the previous. Like, everything looks a little bit too like rounded. Like, it's just like a different set of artists, you know?
Yeah.
The one thing I do like is you can unlock different, not outfits, but like the king's protrusions, head protrusions, you can restyle those. And there's all sorts of different patterns that you can apply to them. And those look pretty nice. And you can dress them up, I think, as well, which there's some fun outfits in there, but I don't know.
I'd rather not talk about the king's protrusions, thank you. But I thought this game was okay to play. Like, it was fine. It's short.
Very short.
Especially if all you're doing is playing the kind of basic levels that are there. I don't think there's a ton of kind of new stuff. That stupid cow bear level comes back. Of course it does.
Yeah,
but,
50 items.
But yeah, I didn't have strong feelings for this game kind of one way or the other, except that it does horrifying art aside, it does look very nice because of the Vita screen, as was mentioned previously. I did pull my Vita back. It's my Vita. I don't have the fear of it dying quite like I do my PS3, but I also hadn't charged it in a while and I couldn't find my charger. So I had to actually order another charger in order to play this on my Vita. Fortunately,
I brought my Vita back to life to play this game, which is I switched on my Vita and it wouldn't switch on, so I did have to replace the battery, which I'm glad I did, because now I've got another, I've working Vita. But yeah, it's all right. You can very easily finish this in one setting. It's got 13 main levels without the DLC levels. You could quite comfortably finish it in one sitting if you're not really bothered about points.
The new features in this one, you can use the touchscreen to control movement. That is an optional way to control the game, kind of like the Bayonetta games when they came to Wii U. They gave you that like touchscreen option, or maybe that was a Switch version. I don't remember. But anyways, the title comes from the new feature where you can use the back panel touch interface from the Vita to either squish or stretch your Katamari to be either really tall and narrow or really kind of long and wide. And that can help you fit through gaps and under objects.
I did that accidentally more than I did it intentionally.
Yeah, it never really is that useful. It's an interesting idea, but I don't know. It doesn't really add that much.
I got myself out of getting stuck a couple of times with squishing it, but that was pretty much it.
Yeah, I just played around with it and kind of saw what it can do and just largely forgot about it.
Yeah, you can earn candies by playing levels and by playing on consecutive days. It has that like mobile game kind of like check-in loop thing where you get more and more every day consecutively you check in. And you can spend that on like cosmetics and stuff like that, but I don't know. The DLC added a few additional levels. The only interesting ones that I wanted to point out, mostly levels just from previous games like the snowman and the shopping mall. There is a level called We Love Pac-Man, in which you start off in a Pac-Man maze and you roll up the pack dots and fruits and ghosts and stuff. And I think you can eventually break out of the maze walls. There is a downhill race that is a an actual race. And as you are rolling and trying to place first, you can roll up the other racers as well if you are large enough. Nice little twist on that. There's one called Katamari Soccer that is basically a standard rolling level on a big football pitch. So that's a nice little touch as well.
Why did they give the king human teeth? I'm still stuck on this. I just hadn't seen this before, and it's...
Even the humans didn't have human teeth.
No.
It's the eyes and the teeth. That's what bothers me here.
Well, then.
Also, the fact that he eats the Katamari in this one. We didn't mention that. He does eat the Katamari. It's not that I hate that he's eating the Katamari. I think it's just that I hate that he's eating the Katamari combined with the human teeth.
Yeah, I feel like with this and maybe others... iterations in the series that they're trying to be funny. You know, it's like, what can we do to make this game funny? How can we make people laugh? Where I get the impression with the first game and the second game, whilst I mean, he says in his design philosophy he wanted the game to be humorous. I think there's a difference between making something humorous and trying to make something funny. I think kind of making something funny, obviously it's subjective, but it kind of just happens as a result of other things, where I always feel like they've been chasing the feeling of particularly the first game. The second game is a bit acerbic for me, the whole tone of it, but I feel like with all of the others, they're like, how can we recapture that feeling that the writing in the first game gave people? And there's just been a series of diminishing returns, and it kind of unfortunately culminates here in the Vita game.
Yeah, I was just looking. There's some article on a website called relyonhorror.com that I was skimming and looks interesting, giving this an honorable mention in horror games, saying that it is basically, yeah, like just a pure cosmic horror game, that the king in this one is so incredibly cruel that, yeah, I kind of want to play it now, actually. I'll have to see if we have it at the game center, I guess.
It'll take you about an hour and 20 minutes, yeah, Jesse.
It sounds like a rich text.
There are a couple of additional mobile games that we should get through. There is Tap My Katamari, which has also been delisted. This was released on iOS and Android in January of 2016, and it played as a 2D endless runner.
I think this is the one that I played briefly, just like on the timing wise. I think that this would have been like me on a commute. That I don't really have anything to say about it, just that I did touch a mobile Katamari at one point.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a game called Amazing Katamari Damacy, also delisted as of now. This released on iOS and Android in December of 2017. It has a 3D endless runner type of but like in a lane, kind of like Subway Surfer or those Crash Bandicoot levels. Let's get back to our community. We have some three-word reviews, which we have sourced from Twitter. We put out a tweet on the day of the recording, and come back and see if the community can summarize the game any more succinctly than we can with a maximum of three words. Print-size reviews.
Joe Bobonobo says, sublime and bizarre.
Bear Fish Pie, see me rollin'.
Hypnocrite, na na na. We'll give him that, eh? Three words, just.
Quiet Paul says, cute, fun, challenging.
Warren John Hughes says, best soundtrack ever.
Scoush says, roll with it.
Bearfish Pie says, disappointed parent simulator.
Blue Weasel Breath says, banging theme song.
Robin Hoodie says, highness, origami, vroom.
Zapped to the says, grin-inducing madness.
Hot Dog Cast says, the purest joy.
It's Hayes Hill with Rollin', Rollin', Rollin'.
Oh, thank you very much for all of our community members. This leaves it to us to summarize our own thoughts on this weird and wonderful series. Jesse, why don't you start us off here?
Since the dawn of time, man has yearned to destroy the sun. That is a quote from The Simpsons that I've been thinking of when we were, you know, talking about rolling up the sun and And I'm sure there's some original parts of my personality in here somewhere, but, you know, mostly it's Simpsons quotes and Katamari thoughts and related things. And going back to this game has been so odd because it really is one of my favorite games of all time, but it is not a game I play that often. And it has not dated for me, but it occupied a very particular moment in time for me, and that will cement it always as kind of being in my top five, even if it is not in practice. There's something almost heroic about it for me. And I do look at Keita Takahashi's subsequent career with not disappointment, but a band whose debut album, Marquee Moon comes out and everything else Tom Verlaine does is great and Swell and all that. But, you know, it's not Marquee Moon. There is this quality of everything he's done sort of circling around this idea of games. And, you know, he's designed playgrounds. He's a super interesting guy, and his main interest may not even be in games, but this being this one moment where his skepticism about games and kind of the sort of pure form of games come into collision in this perfect way that just is lightning in a bottle. And yeah, and again, like, you know, the first one and the second one, I don't know which one. I probably would play the second one more because it has so many interesting, fun, goofy levels. But the first one is kind of the classic in a way. And then I will admit that I confused Beautiful Katamari and Katamari Forever. But I'm going to go play Beautiful Katamari. I'm very interested in that super long level. And I don't think there's this weird tension between my personal attachment to these games and Takahashi is kind of this art hero when I needed one in the context of games, and the fact that these are, you know, that the PS3 one looks nicer and they're polished and there are interesting new mechanics. So I will leave it on that note of ambivalence, but yeah, incredibly important game. And if you haven't played it somehow and have listened to this whole thing, obviously play it.
Perfect. Our newcomer, Chris.
Yeah. Six, leaving aside the mobile games, six Katamari Damacy games in 7.5 years. And that includes a gap between Katamari Forever and Touch My Katamari. So that's a lot of Katamari in a relatively short space of time. I would venture as far to say that there never needed to be more than one, because the games have really just repeated what was done in the first game over and over again. Yes, there are moments of invention there, particularly in We Love Katamari, and then brought back in Katamari Forever. But really, the concept of sitting back at the end of a day, picking up the controller, switching your brain off, and just rolling over these levels, and that really satisfying suction sound when you roll something up, remains as compelling in the last game as it did in the first game. They just bolted on things which, to my taste, took away from the appeal. A too wordy king, an unfair and very difficult to kind of really fathom scoring system, just takes away from that absolute purity and almost kind of zen-like. I actually found the first game really relaxing. You know, I didn't find it too challenging. And it was that kind of, you know, when you're playing other games, other duty games, as I say, you know, for Kayla Rinter and any other things that we do, this was a breath of fresh air when I first started playing this in December. It was a really relaxing time. The other games introduced things which kind of, for me, detract from that. So whilst the series as a whole is still enjoyable, because the core gameplay is enjoyable, and a special mention for Katamari Forever, just for bringing together some of the best levels from the whole series and sticking them in one package. For me, the first game is essential, and I kind of wish they'd stop there, because if I go back and replay a Katamari game, I will only replay that original PS2 game. That is good enough for me.
Thank you very much. How about you, Leah?
Yeah, so I am actually kind of glad that I went back and played my kind of series replay like I did, sort of similarly to how Chris did it, except I had played them before, because it was a really neat way to kind of see how the series has evolved and changed, some things for the better and some things maybe not so much, at least in my opinion. But What it really did cement for me is just how much joy these games can bring me. I'm a person who is prone to anxiety, and I get stressed out a lot, which is something that I'm sure that pretty much everybody can relate to. So, just having something where the stakes are really low, the feedback is really satisfying, and I can just kind of sit back and roll things up into my life is fun, you know, and it's something that you can just kind of, you don't have to be paying super hard attention. You don't have to have tons of strategy. And the worst thing you're going to get is a talking to from the king, who is probably going to do that anyway. So, you know, you can't take it too seriously. He's most of the time funny, except in that last game where he's haunting my nightmares to this day. But I mean, I really like these Katamari games. And the first two, while I did mention before that I think that Katamari Forever is probably my favorite overall, the first two games in the series have those really nice remasters that are very readily available and hold up great. So if you haven't played these games before, that's a great place to go for them. You don't have to play all of them because there is a lot of repetition sometimes, and a lot of things that have relatively minor changes, but I do recommend at least doing a little bit of rolling, because, you know, you just wad everything up into your life. It's fine.
Very nice. And then I'll take us out just by briefly saying that I know that Leon probably wouldn't like me saying this, but he's not here, is he? So Katamari is kind of the most video game that a video game has ever been, in a way. Like, it's abstract, it's tactile, it's silly, it's colorful, it has all the right kind of music, it's both score chasing but at the same time kind of zen and relaxing, and allows you to just exist within a space. It tells its story through its environment and through the connections that individual players can choose to notice or not notice and draw connections themselves. It just feels like every aspect of this operates on such a masterful level of artistic expression, and is somehow through the chaos of its silliness is able to communicate something, I think, pretty profound philosophically as well. If you kind of take it as a whole, you do walk away with the feeling of Keita Takahashi feeling like everything in the universe is kind of connected, and we all share this some kind of a innate link, us and the animals and even our objects and our trash and his environmental feelings as well, of wouldn't it be great if we could just roll up everything that we didn't need, all the little distractions in life that that clutter our workspaces and that clutter our minds and our lives, and just throw them into space and to make something beautiful out of them, to make new planets, to make new stars, to think that the elements that we look up into the sky and we see them are actually made out of little units of meaning, that there's something valuable about a planet that's made of only rice makers or whatever. You know, it's like, it's something that feels very liberating and very profound about Katamari as well, for as silly as it is. I think the games are incredibly fun. I think that they are uniquely incredibly fun for people of all different skill levels, from people who have never picked up a video game controller before to absolute experts in the field. There's just something that is like irreducible about Katamari Damacy. While I think the first two games are really the standouts, we love Katamari. Katamari Forever is the first one that I ever owned. It's going to kind of have that place in my heart forever. I think it's a wonderful greatest hits collection, and I would love for it to be more playable as like a really easy recommendation for people. But if people are looking to get started with the series, the recent remaster of We Love Katamari is just wonderful, and it plays great. It looks great. It has all of the most inventive levels from throughout the series. It's just a delight. So I really can't recommend this series enough. There's a lot of doing the same thing if you're playing it all back to back like we have, but it's just, it never gets boring. It's always so kind of funny and just tactile and innately fun in a way that very few video games just get to that level of just sheer toy-like playfulness. So I like it a lot. It's a high recommendation from me, and I'm really glad that we had the chance to finally cover it on Cave Ignorance to celebrate its 20th anniversary. That takes us out of the Katamari series, and it remains for me, Ryan, to thank Leah, Jesse, and Chris, as well as our correspondents, plus, of course, you for listening. Next time, join us in issue 605 for Brave Fencer Musashi.